of your grief stretches endlessly into the future. No hope, no relief, no rewards, no change, ever. During that summer, I stood shakily on the tightrope of my lonely self. Each time I wavered, I saw below me the pit of madness, beckoning me to join the other lost souls who had given up the fight and slipped into a special world. It was a terrifying journey. I was the solitary traveler, somewhere during each day, suspended just above the beckoning chasm, hovering unsteadily, feeling my grip slipping. I was 16 years old. The picture Mother was about to make was Autumn Leaves with Cliff Robertson, directed by Robert Aldridge. Though she was working in Los Angeles, I didn't see Mother during the months she was in town. In fact, I barely spoke to her on the phone because she said her schedule was so hectic that she didn't have much free time. Truthfully, I was just being ignored. It was October when the announcement came out of the blue. Mother called to say that she was taking the entire family to Switzerland for Christmas. There was no explanation, no discussion, no mention of the year that it had been since the family had seen one another. I had not been home or seen Mother even once in the last 18 months. What had changed? I racked my brain, but I couldn't find any answers. I still had not met Alfred Steele, her husband of 5 months. I had not seen my brother or sisters in a year. Sister did confide in me that after Mother and Mr. Steele were married, all my back school bills started being paid. I took a chance and called Mrs. Chadwick. She confirmed it. The back bills at Chadwick were also being paid. Since nothing else had changed, I could only guess that Mr. Steele was the reason we were all going to Europe on this trip. I was so excited by these sudden changes I could hardly think about anything else. We were all going to Europe for Christmas. I was getting new clothes. I could hardly believe it. Chris and my sisters were home from their schools, too. We rushed into one another's arms, laughing and hugging. They were just as surprised as I'd been to hear the news of our trip. Chris had grown more, and he was taller than I. The girls hadn't changed much, except that they were, of course, a year older. I was 16 and a half, Chris was 13, and the girls were almost 8. I first saw Alfred Steele swimming in our pool. I remember standing on the steps leading out to the garden and asking Mother, what was I supposed to call him?
What would you call anyone who was your father? She asked me.
I had to think about that for a moment. It had been 10 years since she'd been married before. I'd never really had a father. There had been lots of her lovers I'd had to call uncle, but that didn't seem appropriate. The problem was that it seemed preposterous to call a stranger Daddy. I'd never been introduced to him as Mr. Steele. I'd never seen him before in my life. It was very confusing, but I wanted to be as polite as possible and do anything I could to please her, so I finally decided on Daddy. Mother turned to me and said, "He's too fat, he wears glasses, and he's slightly hard of hearing in one ear, but he's a nice man. Go introduce yourself." That was how she described her husband of less than 6 months. I felt sorry for him already. The disdain in her voice transmitted her message clearly. I walked down to the pool alone. When I got near the edge, I stopped and waved at the man in the pool. He swam up to where I was standing and smiled at me. I kneeled down and stuck out my hand. "Hello, Daddy. I'm Christina." He took my outstretched hand in his dripping wet one, and I knew immediately that I was going to like him. Alfred Steele was a very direct man. He'd started out as a geologist, graduating from Northwestern University in Chicago. By what path he went from geology to sales at Coca-Cola, I never quite understood. But from Coca-Cola, he went to Pepsi-Cola. He did not stand very tall, 5'10", maybe, but Al Steele was a big man, and people loved him.
At long last, the moment had come. Mother, the girls, Chris, and I were boarding the train for New York. Mrs. Howe was also with us to take care of my sisters. It was December 8, 1955. We arrived in New York early in the morning of the third day. Daddy and the press photographers were there to meet us. I realized I wasn't used to having pictures taken anymore, and my mouth was beginning to hurt from trying to smile for the cameras. These were the first family pictures we'd had taken with Daddy. In fact, these were the first family pictures we'd had taken in almost 4 years. Friday, December 16, 1955, we sailed aboard the Cunard luxury liner Queen Mary for Europe. Mommy and Daddy had a party in their stateroom suite for friends and the press. We dutifully waved and smiled for all the photographers, and then we were sent back to our own rooms. After 5 days of rain and stormy seas, we arrived in Cherbourg, France, where we waved and smiled for the photographers again, and then boarded the boat train for Paris. In Paris, we took the waiting limousines to the George V Hotel to bathe and change clothes. Before we got on the next train for Switzerland that night, Daddy took us on a brief tour of the city. Finally, the narrow-gauge train stopped at Saint Moritz Station. There were horse-drawn sleighs waiting to take us to the Palace Hotel. The bells on the horses jingled just like Christmas carols, and the big furry lap robes in the sleigh protected us from the cold. The sky was crystal clear blue, and I was sure I was dreaming. I was sure I was going to wake up soon, back in my room at the convent. During the next few days, we barely saw Mommy and Daddy. Chris and I went skiing all day. The girls played in the snow and went ice skating, and we all checked in once a day with our parents. I was even allowed to go out dancing at night with the young men I met on the ski slopes. Mother and I only had one unpleasant encounter on the ship returning to New York. She and Daddy hadn't been getting along very well. Mother was drinking heavily again. She always had her 100-proof vodka with her in little flasks that had specially designed covers to match her clothes. We brought cases of that vodka with us to Europe, hidden throughout all our luggage. One night, Mother had been drinking steadily since long before dinner, and when it came time to say good night, I kissed her on the cheek and turned to leave the stateroom. Daddy came back into the room just then, and I went to kiss him goodnight, too. She whirled around and slapped me hard several times. It was the first time she'd hit me in front of Daddy. I blushed crimson, but she slapped me again, saying, "I got my man. Now you damn well go out and get your own." She shoved me toward the door. Daddy started to say something to her, but she told him to shut up. I left them arguing. Damn her. Why does she always have to ruin everything? All I wanted was a father. I certainly had no designs on her new husband. I barely knew him. Nevertheless, from that point on, Mother never allowed me to be with Daddy alone. When we arrived in New York City, there was a large crowd of Pepsi people and photographers on hand to greet us. Again, we smiled and posed for the happy family pictures. On a cold day near the end of January 1956, I flew back to Los Angeles by myself. When I returned to school on Sunday, Sister's gentle face was a welcome sight. During the next few weeks, I told everyone about our fabulous tour of Europe. I had gone home with my friend Gay on several weekends between the time I'd returned from Europe and the end of February. Gay's mother had married Myford Irvine a few years before, and they lived on the original Irvine Ranch in Tustin, California. Gay and I had been friends since we'd both gone to Chadwick. I talked Gay into driving me out to our former school for a visit. It had been a year and a half since I'd seen the Chadwicks. I wanted to tell them all about our magical trip and to let them know that things were finally beginning to go all right for me again. At first, I couldn't imagine how my mother found out about this visit. I put the pieces together when I learned that Mrs. Chadwick had written a letter to my brother mentioning my visit. She had no way of knowing that her letter would be forwarded to the house on Bristol. Mother was still in Jamaica soaking up the sun when all hell broke loose. This letter was handwritten. "Christina, dear, I'm shocked beyond belief that you would go to the Chadwicks. I forbid you to ever go there again or see them. If you do, I will not send you to Carnegie. I see that I cannot trust you any more than I ever could. All of your enthusiasm, your loving attention is surface and as false as ever. You pour it on only to get what you want. And if you think I haven't recognized that all during our Christmas holiday, then you have another thought coming. Your dad and I both saw it constantly and remarked on it. I really feel sorry for you. You're cheating yourself because you are so artificial. You will never be a warm, real human being. You promised if you could come home for Christmas, I would see a new you. You would prove to me that you had changed. You haven't changed one iota, Tina. You are as artificial as all that makeup you constantly wear. All the compliments you received in New York were to make you happy. But you should have heard what people really said about your temper, about your too much makeup, your sophisticated, snobbish manners. After you graduate, I'll have something planned for you until college open. You are not bringing your qualities into our home again. I will not have the babies subjected to them. And don't try to tell me you will change, because I won't believe it. Between you and Christopher, I think I've had it.
This upload presented by the concluding chapter of Crawford.
This handwritten letter had no signature. It just ended at the bottom of the last page. Well, that was it. I'd made a fatal error in judgment. I thought things had changed. I thought that no one would ever find out if I made a short trip to see my former foster parents. It never dawned on me that Mrs. Chadwick would inadvertently give me away. I had been allowed to do so much over the past few months that I thought my life had changed, that perhaps I was going to be able to live normally now. But I was wrong on all counts. I apologized to Sister and told her that I knew it was wrong not to tell her, but I also knew that Mother wouldn't give me permission for the visit, and I actually thought I was sparing all of them. I thought I could do something I wanted without hurting anyone else. Mother's hatred of the Chadwicks, simply because they loved me, turned on me full force. She hated them for knowing the secret person she really was, and she hated them for trying to help me. Unable to get back at them directly, she lashed out at me. As it turned out, I was hurt most of all. She never once called to talk to me about any of this. She just made her pronouncements and issued the orders for punishment. In an odd way, things were back to normal again. My visit to the Chadwicks took place in February. My punishment lasted until the following September, when I was sent off to college. I was once again confined to the school campus. I continued to send cards and to call her on every holiday. I don't know why, really. I didn't know what else to do. Maybe I couldn't admit to myself that it was a completely hopeless relationship. My friend Gay was having a huge graduation party. Her parents, the Irvines, had invited every girl in the senior class and their parents. Everyone had accepted, even the parents of the girls from Central and South America who were traveling thousands of miles to see their daughters graduate. I had written Mother to ask permission to go to the party. On May 31st, I received the following. Christina, dear, you are not to go to any of the graduation parties that are off the school grounds of Sacred Heart Academy. This includes the party given by Mr. and Mrs. Irvine. I've already written them that you cannot come. Your graduation present for me was to have been airline tickets to go to London while I'm making the film Story of Esther Costello this summer, and you were to go on location with me to Scotland and Ireland as well as England. But since you disobeyed me and visited the Chadwicks, I am afraid this is out of the question. You wrote me that you are willing to suffer the consequences. Do you really think it was worth it? I would like to remind you again that if you leave the grounds of Sacred Heart Academy, you will not be able to go to Carnegie Tech. My love always, Mommy. I ran to my room and threw myself across my bed, kicking and screaming and crying. That evil goddamn bitch! She's just a mean, rotten bitch to the marrow of her bones. This letter is only intended to stick the knife in a little deeper, to prove how much and how effectively she can hurt me. This letter was intended to make me crazy, and it succeeded. How I wish I had never been so honest. She already told me I had to stay in school all summer again. She's the queen bitch, and she'll never forget a punishment in just 4 months. 4 months isn't nearly long enough to torture bad, ungrateful, artificial Christina. 4 months? Ha! Huh. just a drop in the bucket. Not nearly long enough to make the point that Mommy Dearest is the powerful one. Mommy Dearest holds the only key. Mommy Dearest's will must be done. On June 11th, the day before graduation, and also my 17th birthday, I received this special delivery letter. Tina, darling, I'm so very sorry, but I'm working and I won't be able to attend your graduation exercises. I have to work all day on Tuesday at the studio to get my clothes ready, and then take your daddy to the airport in the evening. All my love, Mommy. I crumpled the blue Joan Crawford stationery into a ball and clenched it in my fist. God, I hated her. I realized during the quietness of that summer that I had learned a lesson from the special life of the convent. As much as I had originally hated it, I had come in contact with my own loneliness, my own abyss of uncertainty, my own hatred and impatience. I had never known the kind of pain I'd felt during these long months of solitude. There was no escape for me. I had to find a way to face myself, learn to live with myself, and begin to be patient with myself. Patience. I had come face to face with my own nemesis. Patience, the curse of the young. Patience, the secret weapon of survival. I thanked Sister for her understanding, her many kindnesses toward me. I was a difficult person. I tended to brood and to turn inward upon myself. She had met me with gentleness, with wisdom, and with love. I admired her deeply. College surpassed my expectations. Most extraordinary was the sudden freedom. I ventured slowly into this new world of personal responsibility. The rules were minimal, and no one seemed to function as the overseer I was used to having. It was an opportunity to be an individual, to grow as a person. I soon realized that I had no idea who I really was. Most of my energy growing up to this point had been spent coping with schoolwork and my mother's personality. Very little time had been spent deciding what I wanted out of life. Now, each day brought these decisions and their consequences. I still always had to resolve differences between the public fantasy of Joan Crawford's daughter and the reality of my own life. But there were new friends, new ideas, and an open exchange of thoughts that changed my perspective on the world. I felt a growing acceptance as a young aspiring actress. It was the commonality of our dreams that bound my friends and me together, not the differences in our backgrounds that mattered so much anymore. I was in New York on my 18th birthday. As a surprise, Daddy gave me his 1957 Thunderbird convertible. We went down to the street in front of their Sutton Place apartment, and there it was, parked at the curb, all shiny and unbelievable. I hugged and kissed both of them and cried. Westport Country Playhouse, where I was to be an apprentice, was a jewel among summer stock theaters run by the Theater Guild in New York. Because it was only 50 miles from the city, everyone wanted to play Westport. We had the best shows and stars of the season. When Mother and Daddy returned to New York, I called and had a long talk with my mother. We agreed that if I wasn't accepted by the Neighborhood Playhouse in New York for that fall, I'd return to Carnegie for another year. Shortly after that, they left for Africa and were out of the country for the rest of the summer. I was just as scared about moving into the Big Apple as any other 18-year-old kid ever was. I had no practical knowledge of how the real world worked. What others seemed to take for granted was a mystery to me. I didn't know anything about getting things done. When a girl from the theater and I decided to share an apartment in New York that fall, I was afraid to ask questions for fear of looking like a fool, so I listened to other people. It was a very inefficient way to go about life. I also had days of depression so severe that I couldn't face going to school. Instead, I'd stare out at the 59th Street Bridge in the rain and write poetry that didn't make much sense. Then, in a complete turnabout, Mother told me that she'd accepted an appearance on the Jack Parr show for me. She told me what dress I was to wear and had this show send over all the questions I'd be asked. The questions were all about Joan Crawford, not about me. Down through the years, I came to know that pattern so well, I could anticipate the questions in advance. That was the first time I felt the public lie I was telling. It was one of those awful trade-offs when you think you'll be able to deal with your own betrayed value system later. The problem is that the lies are always now. The feeling about yourself is always now, not later. Mother sent me a telegram saying how wonderful I was. I was a credit to my mother, but there was nothing of me in that show except my physical presence. I felt like a fraud. If I'd had 1 ounce of common sense, I'd have scrapped my childhood dreams of becoming an actress and done something else with my life, right then and there. The last time I saw my father was during a heated discussion about the future course of my life that took place in their apartment during September 1958. My parents wanted me to stay in school, and I wanted to get a job. It was a typical parent-child communication problem shared by millions of private families across the country, but we were not a private family, nor did we have a particularly resourceful relationship. Mother wanted things her way. Daddy tried to mediate. She told him to shut up, and before it was all over, I was on my own. I was 19 years old. One night, a few weeks later, there was a knock on my door. There before me stood Jimmy, Daddy's valet and bodyguard. He seemed in a hurry and was talking very fast, looking over his shoulder down the hallway as though he was afraid of being followed. He made me nervous, but I asked him inside. He stepped through the doorway but wouldn't come any further. "Your dad sent you this," he whispered, thrusting something into my hand. Then he said, "Don't let anyone know. It's just between your dad and you. Don't say nothing about it." I nodded okay. In my hand was a $100 bill. Tears welled up in my eyes. "Your dad says to tell you he sends you his love and hopes you're getting along all right." As Jimmy was nearly out the door, I grabbed his arm and said, "Tell Daddy I'm just fine, and thanks." Alfred Steele died of a heart attack in April 1959, just 1 month before the celebration of my parents' 4th anniversary. He was 54 years old. Mother had been made an honorary board member of Pepsi in honor of her late husband. She'd also been put on the official Pepsi payroll and continued the work she'd begun with Daddy. Because of an unfortunate prank at school, my brother Chris was in serious difficulty with Mother. Shortly afterwards, he came to live with me. I was 19, he was nearly 16 years old. We'd managed to survive once more. But ironically, Mother won too. She'd achieved what she started out to do. She was no longer responsible for her adopted son. What followed was a year fairly typical of an aspiring young actress. I did summer stock and winter stock. I did a small part in an independent film. I went from job to job, trying to make ends meet and learn my craft. There were no guarantees, no going home again, as some of my friends were able to do, no assurances during these days. I lived a good deal of my life scared, scared of being alone in the city, scared of not being able to pay my bills, scared of walking the streets at night by myself, and scared most of all of failing. I was still young, but I dared not look ahead too far into the future. It was enough just to get through each day. Before leaving for Miami to do my first film, I'd had several long talks with a freelance writer who was interested in doing a national magazine story on me. I was one of the first Hollywood kids to go into the business as an actress, and there was evidently story value in that, as well as my own personal experience. The article was published in October 1960. The story was called "The Revolt of Joan Crawford's Daughter." It caused quite a stir. Less than a month later, I received a wire from Jerry Wald offering me a part in his next picture starring Elvis Presley. Then came an offer of a long-term contract with 20th Century Fox Studio, and I was summoned to the West Coast for a screen test. It was just like all the movie magazine stories, only it was really happening to me. I tried to remain calm through the whole uproar, but it was impossible. My part in the picture was very small. My billing in the picture was much larger. Before I finished shooting my small part, Jerry Wald called me into his office. I didn't think much about it since I'd been to see Jerry numerous times over the past few months. He was clearly uncomfortable. Your mother has just informed me that she is unable to do return to Peyton Place, he said, almost in tears. He went on to say that she'd told him she was very sorry, but other commitments prevented her from doing his film. He looked at me and said, We've been discussing this for months. It was all set. All that was left was to sign the contracts. What do you think happened? Jerry was extremely agitated now, pacing up and down behind his desk. He said that he got the impression she wouldn't do his next film because he'd hired me to do the Presley picture. He had the distinct feeling that she was angry with him for helping me. A week later, I finished shooting, and the next day, my long-term contract was canceled. I never worked at Fox Studio again. For nearly a year, I continued in Hollywood, but without much success. Finally, I just gave up. I disappeared. My life was in a shambles. Whatever progress I'd made during the New York years seemed to fall apart now. I lived quietly in a little house in Laurel Canyon. Eventually, I took an undemanding job at a savings and loan in Hollywood, spending my free time fishing, working in my garden, and reading books on Eastern philosophy. The man I lived with was my first real love. Through him, I began to learn to trust in another human being. This was the first time I sensed some order to the universe, some meaning to my lifelong pain. If my relationship with Mother had something to do with the concept of karma, then perhaps it wasn't total absurdity. There was a reason I was put on Earth, a life lesson I had to learn. The movie Whatever Happened to Baby Jane was released in 1962. It was the most successful picture Mother had made in many years and the last important film of her career. It was 1964 before I ventured into show business again. When I returned, it was to the theater where I felt most secure. I'd gotten an audition in New York for the Chicago company of Barefoot in the Park. Nearly a month later, I got a call in Los Angeles that I'd been hired. This was the best job I'd ever landed, and I was proud of myself. The work went very well. The reviews were terrific. That season, I received the Chicago Critics Award for Best Young Actress. It was April of 1966, after a hurried courtship, that Harvey, my director from Barefoot in the Park, and I decided to get married. We were married on May 20th, 1966. After our honeymoon on Cape Cod, my husband and I returned to our New York apartment. Only a few weeks later, Harvey left to direct the London production of Odd Couple. I was not in the least bit lonely. I visited Mother nearly every other day, basking in our mutual homecoming and enjoying every minute of it. I had a new apartment to settle, a new life to manage, letters to write, and my mother's love.
This upload presented by the concluding chapter of Crawford.
In April 1968, I started work on a daytime soap opera at CBS. Mother loved the soaps, and we had fun discussing my new job on Secret Storm. I played a neurotic young wife with a passion for mischief who developed a drinking problem when she suspected her husband of seeing other women. Mother watched every show I was on, even when she was out of town. I gave her a list of air dates, which she carried with her, and even sent to her friends. Her own fans started writing her about how much they liked the show. She was visibly pleased with their reaction. My husband was away most of the summer. For the first time, I was really lonely. We had not been getting along very well lately, and even my going into therapy didn't seem to be helping our relationship substantially. I spent most of my free time with my mother. By the middle of summer, I decided that it would be best for both my husband and myself if we got a divorce. It was better, I thought, to admit we'd made a mistake and separate, rather than to continue causing each other misery. We had no children to consider, no community property. The beginning of October, I flew to Mexico to get my divorce. Mother helped me make the arrangement. I thought that it was just the strain I was under with the divorce and the long hours of work on the soap opera that were making me feel ill. I was tired and losing weight. One cold October morning, I woke up at the usual time, around 6 o'clock. Before an hour had passed, I knew I was terribly ill. I broke into a cold sweat as the pain in my abdomen became worse. I was very scared. The last thing I was able to do was to call my mother. From then on, I remember hearing nothing except sirens and doors opening, people in white moving me from place to place. The doctor at the hospital was only a blurry image, although I could hear him say that I had to have an operation immediately. I was sure I was dying. I was terrified. I was all alone and dying. I prayed to God to help me. I never said goodbye to my mother. The anesthetic was administered, and I slipped away. In the recovery room, I dimly saw the face of a doctor I recognized. I managed to whisper, "Tony, am I going to die?" He assured me I was going to live. The operation had been successful. The fallopian tumor was benign. I slipped away into unconsciousness. The next morning, I awoke to see the doctor with my mother and Gloria, my director from the show. Quietly, Gloria started speaking to me. She was trying to tell me that my mother had offered to play my part on the soap. CBS had accepted her generous offer. After that day, I was not allowed either visitors or phone calls for several days. I was too weak from the major operation and too heavily sedated because of the excruciating pain to do anything but rest. On the fourth day, Mother called me in the evening. Mother's voice over the phone sounded happy and excited. She said work was going very well. She thought there were a few things she wanted to ask me about the part. My hands started shaking. I told her that I had to say goodbye because I was feeling weak. The doctor appeared in the doorway of my room, followed by my nurse. "I think you'd better tell me about it," he said gently. I realized for the first time that he knew. It all started pouring out of me. Mother taking my job, mother an alcoholic, how helpless I felt, how humiliating it was. She sounded like she was having such a good time. All the newspapers wanted interviews. It was going to be in Time magazine. She was a star again. It was my job she'd taken. What could she be thinking of when she did that? She said it was to save my part so they wouldn't replace me, but it was the absolute end of my character's credibility. I was playing a 28-year-old woman. My mother was well past 60. In truth, nothing in recent years had given Mother as much publicity as taking over my part in the soap opera. It was an event that overshadowed the rest of the work and even the program itself. Before it was time for me to be released from the hospital, the first of the shows Mother did was aired. As the scene progressed, my heart sank into the pit of my stomach. She wasn't just nervous. Mother had been drinking when this scene was taped. After the show, I called her. She seemed delighted, but there was a vulnerability in her voice. She said, "I hope you're proud of me." "Of course, I'm very grateful." When I hung up the phone, I felt sick about what I'd just seen on television and sick about the lies I'd just told. I sat in my hospital bed watching the television set with a growing sense of humiliation. Finally, in June 1970, I decided to give Los Angeles another try. I discussed the plan at some length with Mother, and she offered to let me stay for a while in the West Hollywood apartment she had maintained since selling our house years before. In addition, she offered to call some of her friends and see what they could do to help me. I sat there looking at her with tears in my eyes. I went to her and put my arms around her, thanking her as we hugged. She said she'd miss me, but she knew I was going to do very well. In October, just 3 months after my arrival, I was offered my first guest star part on television. The agents called to tell me that the show began shooting on Monday. I dashed to the studio for fittings and could hardly wait to get home and call Mother with the good news. By the time I returned from the studio, it was nearly 7 o'clock in the evening. Oh, I suppose I should have remembered the lessons of the old days and waited until the next morning to call, but it was only about 10 o'clock in New York, and I didn't think she'd be asleep yet. Mother answered the phone, and I bubbled over with the news. I told her that I'd gotten the guest star part on Marcus Welby, that I was playing a nun, and that I was in almost every scene throughout the episode. I was nearly in tears with happiness as I thanked her for her help and said that all the hard work was beginning to pay off. Then I waited for her response. But I waited in silence. Such a long time passed that I thought we'd been disconnected. "Hello, Mother?" An icy voice that sent 30-year chills through me replied only, How did you get the job?
I didn't catch on right away. I realized I sounded defensive. I sounded like a child. I sounded pathetic. Her voice never changed. It was like stone. We didn't talk much longer. She hung up on me in the middle of a sentence. It was 1 week after I'd finished shooting the Marcus Welby show that I was invited to lunch with a friend of Mother's. When we met at the restaurant, he seemed unusually distant. After we ordered, he asked me if I'd spoken with my mother lately. I told him I hadn't talked to her since I started the show. He looked at me carefully. I asked him if there was something wrong. Then he said that my mother had called him several nights ago. He said that Mother was in a terrible rage. He said she went on and on about what a dreadful person I was, how ungrateful I was for all the help she'd given me. Mother told him that the only reason I'd called her was to gloat over the star part I'd gotten when I knew full well that Marcus Welby was the one show she'd always wanted to do. You simply can't believe that, I said. It doesn't make any sense. He didn't say anything. I mean, for God's sakes, I called to share good news, nothing else. I didn't do anything to her. He looked me squarely in the face. Christina, she was on a rampage the other night. I don't know how many other people she called, but I don't think we were the first. It was almost 9 o'clock our time when the call came through. This was a night raid, like the days of my childhood. What was going on in the dark recesses of my mother's midnight mind? What demons and devils overtook her that she made up these things? Why was I the focus of her insanity? Unless I was right there with her, unless I was physically present reality for her, she slipped away into these wild rampages about our relationship and attributed to me all the devils of her own soul. This was another terrible figment of her imagination. In these years, I would have given my mother anything she wanted. I tried every way I knew to show her how much I loved her. She didn't want just my loving devotion. She wanted my entire life. But it was clear to me that I had to find something different to do with my life. As an actress, I would never find my own identity. I loved the work and had grown to hate the rest. It just wasn't right for me anymore. It was a stroke of good fortune when I met David, the man who was to be my second husband. His strength and his confidence in my ability, his belief in me as a human being, enabled me to begin thinking about my life in an entirely new light. I gathered courage from our relationship. I went back to college, first to a small private university and then to UCLA. A year and a half later, I graduated magna cum laude with a Bachelor of Arts degree. From there, I went to USC and the Annenberg School of Communication. I received a master's degree in communication management and went to work in the public relations department of a corporation handling films and videotape. I wrote Mother about each step of my progress. I told her that I had totally restructured my life and was no longer in show business. I wrote her when I received my 2 degrees and then when I got the new jobs. She replied with her congratulations and warm praise. I continued to send presents on the holidays and on her birthday. She seemed happy for me and pleased about my new venture. I had begun to break free. My survival, at least for this phase of my life, was assured once more. David and I were married on Valentine's Day, 1976. It was truly the happiest day of my life. Later that year, I heard that my mother had stopped drinking. I wondered what she would be like now. I realized that my mother had been drinking since I was a small child. I'd never really known her any other way. If what I heard was true, I was happy for her. Her drinking was a major cause of many of our personal problems during the years of my growing up and into adulthood. I had made my peace with her now. I had made peace with myself and my own life. I could only hope that she had made similar peace with me. Her letters indicated that she had. I had gone on to build a life that had nothing to do with who she was or the years of our pain. The weekend of Mother's Day, my husband and I sent flowers to both his mother and mine. I remember it was Friday morning when we ordered the spring bouquets to be delivered, one to Detroit and the other to New York. When we finished, we were standing in our kitchen. I was overcome with an incredible feeling of sorrow and loneliness for no apparent reason.
Then a thought flashed through my head so strongly that I had to sit down. David asked me if I felt ill. I looked so pale. I looked at him through eyes filled with tears. I could hardly say the words, but I had to tell him, "David, I think my mother is going to die very soon." The flowers arrived one day ahead of time on Saturday. They were brought to my mother as she lay in her bed, very ill. She was told that they were from Tina, and she said, "Oh, yes, it must be Mother's Day." She requested that they be placed on the television set where she could see them even lying down. They were the last flowers she ever saw. I remember she'd always said, "Send me flowers while I'm alive. They won't do me a damn bit of good after I'm dead." My mother died on the morning of May 10th, 1977. The funeral service was brief. There is no formal burial service in Christian Science. The woman who had been my mother's last practitioner read from the Bible, and then passages from Mary Baker Eddy. I looked at the woman reading in her clear voice that sounded so peaceful. From her face, I looked at the urn sitting on its pedestal, so plain and nondescript. I noticed that lying across the base of the urn was a single, long-stemmed red rose that had not been there earlier. It was clearly some very personal gesture of love. After the funeral, the family returned to the Drake Hotel. The lawyer asked us to sit down. He was holding a copy of the will in his hand. He flipped several pages over and then handed me the copy, with only the last page showing. There at the top of the final page of the will was one short paragraph which read, "It is my intention to make no provision herein for my son Christopher or my daughter Christina for reasons which are well known to them." I stared at the words in utter disbelief. I looked up from the page to the lawyer's face. He said only, "I'm very sorry, Tina." What in the hell happened to her these last years? For reasons which are well known to them? What had this woman done? Tried to reach back out of the grave to slap me in the face one more time? I realized that she had not made her peace with me before she died. All the years we'd been together had somehow slipped from her memory. I was speechless and stunned. Not because of the money. It would have been a nice gesture, but it wasn't the money. It was the insult. It was the implication that I had committed an unspeakable wrong. It was the humiliating innuendo that was to be left to be publicly interpreted. Everyone I personally spoke with was shocked at what had happened. None of them knew any reasons for it. None of them had any explanation. They expressed not only their condolences, but their sympathy. It seems that about 2 years before her death, a number of different incidents had coincided to change her life substantially. Her drinking had gotten progressively worse over the years until she was unable to go out in public any longer. Her last few public appearances were drunken disasters. Apparently, during one of the rare times when she was left alone in the apartment during the day, she fell and hit her head on the corner of a table. She was unconscious for several hours with a severe wound to her temple and one eye. Though it was evidently a fairly serious injury, Mother refused any medical attention. Pepsi finally retired her. She was well past 65, but the retirement hurt her feelings. She knew it was the end of her professional career. To the best of anyone's knowledge, the last time Mother saw a doctor was also about 2 years before her death. Her health began to decline shortly afterwards. After the serious fall and subsequent head injury, Mother is reported to have stopped drinking. Now she never left the apartment. She was terrified that someone was going to kill her. She refused all dinner invitations, even from close friends. She remained in touch with the world only through the telephone, her mail, and her television set. She made out her last will in October. In December, Mother stopped seeing anyone other than the few people who worked for her and the Christian Science readers who came regularly. She was no longer strong enough to bathe herself, but still refused to receive help. She refused to allow anyone to notify the family, to call for a doctor, or to get medical attention. 2 months before her death, Mother also stopped smoking. The morning of May 10th, 1977, only one woman was with Mother. She realized that Mother had been through a very bad night, but was surprised at the clarity with which she spoke. There were only the two of them in the room when the end finally came. The woman, realizing there was nothing more she could do, began praying. At first, the prayers were silent, but as she realized how close the end really was, her prayers became audible. She was praying aloud, and Mother heard the words. My mother raised her head. The last coherent words from her mouth were, "Damn it, don't you dare ask God to help me." A few minutes later, Mother was dead. After the funeral, the reading of the will, and the memorial service, that was it. The show was over. As David and I walked out into the cool night air, I held on to his hand and thought, God Almighty, at last it is over. I have survived. It is time for us to go forward with vigilance, honesty, and love, for reasons which are well known to them.